I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Here at the Siebel Golf Training Facility at Stanford University, Varsity Golf. Somebody just corrected me as to what the exact title is. I've got a couple architects going to have a lively discussion about golf courses that were built in a certain era and, you know, what to do with them, and then we're going to get to some questions. But I'm joined by Jay Blasey, who's a second-time guest, and Brett Hochstein, with Brett Hochstein Design. Golf Design. You got rid of the golf.
I did. It's just Hochstein Design. Shorter, cleaner.
Very good. Yeah. Little alliteration almost, but it's not an alliteration.
Just a little rhyme, I guess.
I'm off to a hot start. So for anybody that didn't get where we are, we're at the Stanford Golf Practice Facility, and they've got a lengthy name that I've botched. So. Today, we're going to do a podcast about, you know, kind of the dark ages of golf and the courses that we've got all over the place and kind of what to do with them as the kind of, you're seeing a condensing of golf where a lot of golf courses are closing, some good, some bad. And, you know, there's certainly a lot of great courses, but there's also some that leave a lot to be desired with the architecture, the design, and overall the enjoyment of playing them. So, you know, got these two experts here, so hopefully I don't do much of the talking. And, you know, first I wanted to talk about, you know, kind of what these courses are, when they were designed, and how they were, you know, how they were built. So, you know, Jay, you want to kick it off?
Well, I think when we talk about the dark ages, we're often referring to the time, you know, you could pick a starting point, but somewhere maybe from the 50s to the 90s, or more primarily from the 50s to the 80s. And oftentimes it'd be golf courses that, for those of us who love golden age architecture and some of the principles that go with it, these golf courses were built and feature a lot of different elements that don't contain a lot of those same principles, but maybe more importantly, contain a lot of artificial elements, whether that's artificial mounding, or they've created water features, whether those are lakes or waterfalls, heavy on landscaping, lots of earth moving and whatnot. Perhaps the other big thing is just due to advances in technology, whether that's and earth moving equipment and turf grass technology, all of a sudden these golf courses started going to areas where golf wouldn't naturally occur. So swamps and deserts and mountainsides and sites that weren't naturally conducive. So now all of a sudden you're using you're moving lots of earth, you play a hole, then you get on your cart path and drive a quarter mile, and then you go play the next hole and whatnot. So for those of us who love those principles, that period of time that we refer to as the Dark Ages is one that we'd love to forget or do our best to undo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and sort of the reason that it got to that point was that we had all this new technology, big machines, advances in maintenance and agronomy, where we could be greener, have faster speeds, certain heights of cut and all that. And people got really enamored with these new features because they didn't have them before. And instead of doing the right things with it, such as Alistair McKenzie always talked about the bulldozer and you know, what great things it could possibly do. Well, there really wasn't, due to, say, the Depression and wartime and all that, there's not much lineage or connection from the Golden Age all the way to the guys picking it back up in the 60s. So there isn't necessarily that sort of thought to say, let's use this for good and for artistry and for, you know, making conditions that are fun versus just aesthetically pleasing. And that's kind of the direction it all went. And the way it was marketed and the way the public sort of ate it up, I guess.
I think the big shift that occurred as well is, if you think back to the early 1900s, when golf courses were created, typically it was a group of people getting together for the love of golf. And they had a common interest, and they set out to build a golf course because they were interested in golf. And they'd go find an appropriate site. Typically, they'd go search for the right land that had good soils and was gently rolling. During this period we refer to as the Dark Ages, some of that changed, and the purpose for building a golf course changed. So now somebody has a housing development. So the golf course is really the engine to sell houses. Or vice versa, we're building a resort, a hotel. So the golf course is the carrot to fill the hotel rooms. And when the focus or the reasoning behind the golf course existing changed, some of the priorities changed as well in terms of their architecture.
It's interesting. I'm reading The Links by Robert Hunter, and he talks about how the land for golf, like if a club didn't buy the appropriate amount of land, the land price would go up so much after they built the course, because then the housing would come in. And then, you know, the model changed to where it was housing first, golf course second, which, you know, detriment to the golf, and, you know, long term it might be a detriment to the housing also, as we kind of saw with the consolidation that's already happened. But I'm curious, it's something that Brett touched on, was the stop in ideas. Like, not very often does an industry go through like a almost 20-year period where ideas and the flow of ideas stop. And it had to be very crippling, because you saw there's no real connection. There's very few connections from architects in the 50s to Alistair McKenzie. One would be Robert Trent Jones was connected to Stanley Thompson, who was connected to Alistair McKenzie. And that'd be one, but there weren't many. Most of them spawned then from Robert Trent Jones, right?
Yeah, for the most part. You could also say Jack Fleming came from McKenzie, but his mark was fairly limited. I can't really think of two others.
I think the lineage point is a good one, and you know, relating to the Depression and the war and how that impacted things. I may disagree that there was a stop in ideas. Mm-hmm. I think maybe priorities shifted. If you look at golf courses built shortly after the war, I think the guiding principle was functionality. We're worried about costs, and so how do we build something just super efficiently as opposed to necessarily strategically? Mm-hmm. So it may not be the same idea, but I don't know that there was a complete and total stop of ideas.
Yeah.
And as we evolve into the 60s, 70s, and 80s, there were all sorts of ideas. Many who love Golden Age golf might just not like those ideas. The idea of adding lakes and adding waterfalls and adding flower beds and mounding, those were ideas.
There's a rise in popularity of professional golf also. So that could be part of it, where they started to think we need to really, the great player all of a sudden was the forefront focus of golf, like Ben Hogan, and how do you challenge a guy It wasn't the right way to challenge, but they thought, lakes and making them go over, but it made it just insufferable for a regular player. So how many of these courses are still kind of out there? And I think moving forward, what can be done with these golf courses as we look at, this architecture and golf is moving in a different direction from these courses? And you know, they're going to need updates with, you know, when irrigation systems come up. Like, what can we do with these golf courses?
Well, the non-political answer is too many. And I think I'd probably say for as far as public golf and accessible golf goes, it's the majority of courses. And I think that's really had a lot to do with the shaping of our golf culture in general in this country. Just the focus on riding instead of walking, keeping track of your score, and just wanting to play courses that the pros are playing, not necessarily thinking about your own game. And what was the second part of that?
And, you know, what can be done with them? I shouldn't have asked so many questions. Can they be improved for, you know, low cost, or do they need to be, you know, completely overhauled? Like, what could you do with a, you know, a residential course that, say, has only got, you know, limited corridor space? So
that's the one where it's a big challenge. I was going to say it's really site specific.
Mm-hmm.
When you reference where it's really narrow corridors and the routing, which I'd say routing and greens contouring, those are the two most impactful parts of design. And when the routing's compromised with that and limited, you're already really up against it. And so it's the cost of going through and making each individual hole, you know, interesting and compelling. Is that going to make the course good enough and interesting enough to outweigh the cost? I'm not totally sure. There are other examples, though, where the housing doesn't quite as limited or the land isn't limited. One example I thought off the top of my head was a course called the Coyote Club in Southeast Michigan that I grew up nearby. It was built in the late 90s. It's got, you know, all the mounding, the pretty generic bunkering, not a lot of interest. I mean, you find yourself on hole 12 and be like, I'm kind of bored. I should go stop a cart waiting and get a beer. But it's on a pretty nice, gentle piece of ground, mix of land. It's half open, half kind of in the woods, so you can kind of go in and out of it. That's the kind of example where, you know, you could easily fill some ponds, maybe reroute it, rebuild all the greens and bunkers, and come up with something pretty interesting for not that exorbitant of a cost.
I think that we've touched a little bit on some of the issues that are in play, and Brett made a comment earlier which I think is critical for everybody to understand, and that is that as it relates to golf and golf courses, it's 100% site specific. So the right solution at even in the same market, you know, we'll take your Chicago, even two golf courses in Chicagoland, the market could be drastically different from one to another, and therefore the solution, the best possible solution, could be drastically different from one to the other, even in the same market. To Brett's point, I think the potential for improvement is largely based upon the land and the constraints that were placed on it. So housing is a key constraint, road crossings, you know, the routing of the golf course, full-length concrete cart paths. That you touched on earlier, Andy, that they're going to need improvements. You know, golf courses, just in order to survive long-term, you know, just like your house, you need to reinvest. And so the irrigation system oftentimes needs to be redone. That's your biggest single investment. So if and when it's time to redo the irrigation system, that's a great time to look at, is there anything else that we should be doing? Well, is now the time to do bunkers and greens or to change anything else around? And if you have a situation where you have a great piece of ground, but the layout that's on it just isn't very special, doesn't take advantage of the features very well, the natural features of the land, and it's due for infrastructure investment, that's the right time to get in and take a new look and see, could we serve the community better by creating something that relates and is more fun? The other thing is, we know that contraction is going to occur. So there might be an opportunity in a number of places where you've got 18 or 27 holes now that they end up being better served as a 9-hole facility, a 12-hole facility, something different, where maybe you take the good land and reserve it for golf, and the other can become housing or it can become a park or open space or something else. And
soccer field.
You can kill two birds with one stone.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the thing. More I've gotten into this and more I've traveled is like, you know, the dearth of bad options for the public versus good options is it's frightening. Like, you know, like I go to a city, like I play in Chicago, and like there's really only like five public golf courses that I would like actually enjoy going playing. And I play those five all the time when I go play public golf. But like, you know, so many of them, once I've seen about eight holes, I'm like, get me out of here. I don't want to do this. And so many of them are constricted by, like, I mean, like cart paths always stick out to me. Like it's just like, it's hard to almost take a photo without getting cart path in it at some of these places. They cut down the middle of the fairway. But where would you say, you know, and I know it's all site specific, but is it inside 50 yards? If you had a limited budget, where could you do the most, you know, create the most interest for the most bang for your buck? Say somebody had, you know, budget to do a little bit of work, where would you focus the most on?
Around the green. That's because that is where a lot of these golf courses during that period of time are very one-dimensional. You're 9 times out of 10, it's an aerial shot. If you miss the green, you're punished. You're either in rough or in bunker. And in those positions, your only shot out is a sandwich, right? So your approach shot is repetitive all through the entire round, and then your recovery shot is repetitive. So by simply redoing green complexes, you can introduce strategy, you can introduce variety, you can have shots that you can land the ball short and feed the ball into the green, or you can feed it in from the side, or you can have a backstop. You can have short grass around the greens, and now you can use, you know, the putter all the way up to a hybrid and everything in between. So you can add so much more strategy there. So if you only had one place to spend your money, that's it. To Brett's point earlier, even that might not cross the threshold if the routing is totally screwed up and you've got a hole where you play out 280 yards and then turn right and go at a 100-degree angle and go the wrong way, you know. But the bang for your buck's at the green complex, in my mind.
Brett, what do you think are some, you know, to go along with, like, greens, but what are some other, like, of the most important design features that create, like, you know, kind of like a sustainable golf model and playable, you know, obviously fun, but, like, outside of, you know, interesting greens, what would you say are some of the, you know, most important parts of design to creating a place that's really fun to play for the public and you know, you can get people around and that kind of...
I think, well, yeah, definitely the greens, and then going backwards from there, creating more width is one way to do it. Less sort of maintain rough. I'm not a big fan of maintain rough, really. I'd rather just be more short grass. Makes it more interesting, and to the point you bring up, it'll helps get people around faster. It helps people enjoy the game a bit more. Now, even if they're not necessarily thinking about which side of the fairway to be on to gain the advantage, you know, they're getting around and they're having a good time, as opposed to hacking it out under a tree and, you know, some deep lie in the rough or whatever. Thinking about bunkers in interesting ways. Just so that they're... For the mid-handicapper, making them sort of think and taking on challenges. If you step up onto a tee and you go to address the ball, then you kind of step back and think, well, wait a second, should I be doing this? I think that's a great way to engage the golfer and make them, you know, have fun, in my opinion.
It's like, I think it's so important always to... you know, not forget like the thrill of golf for everybody, you know, like the high handicapper still wants to feel the challenge of taking it over a bunker. And, you know, it's, but then you also have to weigh that with like challenging. And that's like, I think placement of bunker, how do you guys go about placing bunkers? Because I've read where some architects do it formulaically and it's like, you know, it's 280 yards, we're going to put a bunker right here. And some guys just throw them out there or want to say, I just put them where it should be. You know, do you,
well, I wanted to follow up or piggyback on what you guys were just talking about earlier in terms of, you know, still providing a challenge to somebody, but can you do it in a way that is more sustainable? So if you look at many of those golf courses built during that period of time, you might have a cluster of five or six bunkers all in one grouping, mm-hmm. in a landing area, right? And then you look at it. One simple thing is to say, okay, well, of that giant, you know, 60-yard area that's all sand and broken up into six bunkers, there's only a 5-yard area that's actually impacting the strategy of the hole. Mm-hmm. If you can get rid of the other stuff, now you've simplified the maintenance practices, you've maintained or enhanced the actual strategic value of it. So those are some of the little things you can go look at an existing golf course and say, hey, these are ways that we can improve it for everyday play.
A course in Chicago did that. They took out, like, it's called Harborside. They took out, like, they removed probably about 60% of the bunkers. Yeah.
I think that if you were to do an inventory of golf courses built in the 1980s, you could probably reduce the sand on 90% of those courses by at least 50% without having a negative impact on strategy and maybe having a positive impact on strategy.
Well, and pace of play.
Oh, maintenance.
Like getting them around. That's a more sustainable. You can get more rounds out. You know, people are going to play more when they play faster, and then also the maintenance side of things. As I was at Ballyneal and they have that 1.5-acre putting green, and I was trying to do the maintenance in my head of that, and it was an astounding number.
Robot mowers, Andy. Yeah, robot mowers.
We need robot mowers. Do they have
They're
them?
Coming. I don't know if they have them at Ballyneal. I know that there are facilities that are starting to use them. Mm-hmm. They're on their way.
Google should start doing that.
They probably did it 30 years ago.
Yeah.
We just didn't know about it.
Google's, oh, we've had that for years.
To your point on bunker placement, again, I think it's site-specific and architect-specific as to how they come about. If you've got a great piece of land that has natural features and natural movement in the land, many times bunkers can evolve based on that natural movement. It's just kind of peeling back whatever vegetation's there and highlighting it. In terms of the hole and strategy of the hole, the closer you get to the green, probably the more the placement of the bunker is something that's actually thought out or designed or crafted, as opposed to just finding it naturally. But I think the days of formulaic bunkering and laying them out at 280 are hopefully past us.
Yeah.
I don't think following any formula in golf design is a good idea. I think just always have an open mind to every single situation.
Mm-hmm. Variety.
Yeah.
That's what keeps people coming back over and over again, and throughout the course of a round, if you can offer different challenges, different opportunities for excitement, different opportunities for escape, those are the things that get people excited and keep them coming back.
Mm-hmm. So let's move to a more positive topic. we got a lot of Twitter questions, so I figured we'll do some overrated, underrated, everybody's favorite, you know, podcast segment, and we'll do some questions. So I fired this off a few minutes ago. So this is So how much, this is a good question from Nate Mowry, how much time planning go into deciding grasses and strains for a golf course when you're building?
It's certainly something that's thought out and typically it's a team effort. Obviously, if it's an existing facility, you're working with the existing superintendent and their team, and then they're usually leaning on agronomists or university researchers that are helping them. So in a perfect world, you can do that a couple seasons in advance, where you could actually do test plots on your own facility. You know, it's one thing to do to check out test plots somewhere else, but if you can do it on your own property, that's always the best advantage. So I think the simple answer is the greater lead time you can have, the better chances for success that you'll have. And the more testing and trials that you can do, the better chance you'll have.
Yeah, I mean, I know I have my own preferences going into something that's generally whatever is going to be, you know, play the firmest and fastest, while also, you know, not being a total burden or extra cost to maintain. And typically those two things, you know, go hand in hand anyway. So it's just a matter of, you know, finding out if that fits within, you know, the client's budget and, you know, their preferences, and with the you know, superintendent is going to be maintaining it. And, you know, I've got a bit of a turf background myself, so I've got you know, a little bit of able to discuss it more in depth, which I think helps. And, you know, I've worked in maintenance, so I understand it, and it's I'd like it to be a two-way thing between the superintendent and you know, architect or shaper, whoever's out there.
Yeah, I think that collaboration helps probably with the whole project too.
So important, it's critical.
I imagine there's like an ownership stake that the more you can get the club or courses staff involved helps after, right?
Yeah, anytime you can get buy-in from the whole team, you know, the idea of coming up with one common vision, right, that we're always working towards, and there might be different ways to get there, but as long as the vision is the vision and that's what we're all working towards, then that's a recipe for success.
So we got two Bay Area residents. As we learned this morning, it takes quite a long time to get around the Bay in the morning on a weekday. What's the most underrated, this is from Connor Doherty, we'll do most underrated Bay Area course, one public, one private.
Good question.
If I could stretch the Bay Area all the way up into just north of Napa County, I would say Etna Springs.
Etna Springs.
Nine-hole old property redone by Dove and the Renaissance guys, I don't know, about 10 or 15 years ago. And it's just, it's really interesting golf. Got some neat greens out there. It moves around the property in a really great way, just in and out of certain aspects of it. And it's just really, it fits the site context, the area, so well. Their cart barn is an old refurbished barn from, you know, the property whenever it was a cattle ranch or whatever it was. And just there's that sort of detail to it. It's just a really special place.
Private course?
Was private, now public.
Wow. So all
so get on up there.
when you're out in wine country with the wife, you know, set up a
wine and nine.
Set up a
wine and nine.
That's good advice. I need to get up there. It's hopefully it's okay with all the fires and everything. So
I think they got away with it, but the drive up there probably kind of depressing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. From a private club standpoint, I don't really know that it's actually underrated or off the radar, but in my mind, probably underrated is Meadow Club, and Sean Tully, the super up there, just continues to help the golf course evolve, and Mike DeVries has done a good job up there, and so that's continuing to just kind of keep evolving and just keeps getting better and better and better with time, and
it's a good
pretty special place.
When a course gets better over the years, you know, so often you see that. The opposite happen where the fairways get narrower, the greens get smaller, and
architecturally minded superintendents are just they're a treasure.
It's all right. Overrated, underrated, the Olympic Club from Connor also. Curious. Hot topic.
Overrated.
All right. Great club, great membership.
All right, we'll go with overrated, underrated from Josh Roby. Double dogleg par fives.
I'm going to throw a caveat in there. So long as you can see and you can play the angles, I'll say underrated. If there's trees, you know, if it's a dogleg left and you got to play around trees, and then the second half goes around trees to the right, so you really can't see or maneuver it, then I'll say overrated. So it's both.
I was trying to figure out how I want to say that, and yeah, that's pretty much it. Yeah, to be able to actually take on the dog, that's
the key.
It's kind of like
a compelling hole.
That fourth hole at Bethpage. You know what there aren't many in the way of the hole?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Trees?
Yeah.
It's pretty pretty. It's a pretty hole.
Yep.
Pretty pretty. It's terrible. All right, Philip Johnson, overrated, underrated? The switchback hole. Brett, you gotta go first this one.
By switchback, are we referring to
it's like a fade tee shot, draw second shot, or a draw tee shot.
I thought you were actually going like reverse angle where you actually play back.
Also, sort of thinking about like the 18th at Lake Chabot, which drops down like 250 feet. It's got a switchback all the way down the fairway.
I'm thinking more conventional, like where something calls for one shot shape, you know, kind of the whole changes in terms of.
I would say that's underrated.
Underrated.
Amen. Underrated.
Yeah, I think that's a cool little thought. Crystal.
Anytime you get angles, anytime you can introduce angles, and it's usually a byproduct of having width. You know, we've already touched on width over and over again today. If you can have width and take advantage of angles, that creates compelling golf.
And encouraging shot shaping.
We gotta change the ball to do that.
Just go straight down.
Not mine.
Curious, this is something I've actually wondered, is about Olympic Club. You know, they have the fairways historically, you know, that every season when they host the tournament, that they'll dogleg one way, but the slope goes the opposite way. What are you guys' thoughts on fairways like that? Like, I don't know what the terminology is.
Reverse camber.
Yeah, yeah, that's reverse camber. I knew it was reverse something.
I'd say just going back to the whole variety thing, if used every once in a while, it can be a good thing. And doing it 18 times in a row, I don't know if that's interesting or fun. I'm not saying Olympic is that, but done right, I'd say it's good to sprinkle that in every once in a while.
I would make 2 points. For everyday golfers, I would say it works far better if the hole moves left to right and the land is moving right to left, just because 90% of golfers fade or slice the ball, so they're hitting into the slope, so it becomes more playable. So that'd be one point. I would echo Brett's sentiment that when done in moderation or as a change of pace, it's interesting. The other caveat I'd put on it is if there's enough room to actually let the ball run out. So a 20-yard wide fairway and a reverse camber to me is not very compelling, because you're just going to end up in the rough all the time. If you actually have enough space to let the ball run out and let it go run 70 yards away, then it's kind of interesting, because now you're encouraging people to hug the right side. If they bail out and they miss, they still have a shot, but now it's much longer, so it can add to the strategy.
Or just a horrible angle.
Yeah,
and you're going back to shot shaping, you're encouraging hitting a draw or a fade into that slope to try and hold it up there, which is interesting, I think.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really, it stimulates, you know, the thought process. That's the key.
Get golfers thinking. That's
yeah.
It.
All right. We've got, here's a good, Drew Nedzinski. What are some modern design features? We've talked about a few of them, but you each get one. Modern design features that we're going to see more and more with newer courses. Maybe they're like newer features that you're seeing pop up in designs. that you think should be used more? I'm adapting this question.
I don't know. I don't necessarily think it's so much new features. It's just in kind of embracing the past, and it all relates back to kind of sustainable golf. You know, we've touched on many of them before.
Sorry, yeah, short grass and contours.
Yeah.
Jay, overrated, underrated offensive linemen scoring touchdowns.
Very underrated. That was it was brilliant because it was a backwards pass. It was actually a lateral, perfectly executed.
Jay's a big Badgers fan, Wisconsin Badgers, so you know.
And we took down the Illini.
They took down my Illini
thanks to an offensive lineman touchdown. He ran for 15 yards.
He's a bad lineman by 14. Yeah. Wow.
I don't think you can talk.
You know, kind of like golf, anytime you can get the ball rolling is a good thing. I think anytime in football you can get a big man running with the ball, underrated.
Absolutely, that's fun.
Gravity has its advantages.
All right, we'll do one more. We're kind of on a time crunch because of the traffic here. Overrated, underrated, Poana Greens.
Overrated in general,
yeah.
What about just embracing the Poe?
Again, it's all site specific. We sound like a broken record when it comes to that. But there's no reason that Poe Greens can't be a great surface.
Mm-hmm.
But on balance, you don't see people striving for it off the bat in general.
And the surface itself, as far as rolling a ball, they can be really great, but it, almost always they're going to be soft and overly receptive, and it's just it's not as interesting as having to think about a green that's going to bounce and roll, and you really have to think about where you're going to land it instead. And you can achieve that better with bent, and in most cases you can. Where there's POA, you can manage bent.
There's Wingfoot, or one of the courses I always like buys the Poa greens that people try and rip out, or ripping out, they're like, we'll take it. They buy it.
Thing to know about Poa is there's, I know just enough about grass to be dangerous, but my understanding is there's so many different strains and lines of it. So when you use that blanket phrase, the Poa that you're talking about in Pennsylvania is different than the Poa that you're talking about in California.
Yeah.
Well, there's a reason they're doing that, because it's really valuable. That's Poa that's evolved, like you said, over 80 years, 100 years, and you're just not going to grow that in the nursery. Mm-hmm. So, of course, that has those types of greens nearby down the road, and it's doing a bunch of greens expansions and doesn't have a big enough nursery, they could really use that.
Yeah.
To help marry up with the current greens.
That's an interesting point. I didn't ever think about it as like green expansion when you have, that's tough.
Well, yeah, if you're expanding greens and you go through the whole process and you're doing all the construction, you see them pull the sod off and set it to the side. If you do the green expansion, when you put that sod back, you haven't covered the whole green. You still got to cover the new wings and everything. So what's the best and most efficient way to make that work?
I'm going to just start a sod farm.
You and Greg Norman.
Do it on site.
Yeah, just do a bunch of them all throughout the country. I'm just going to be buying up little plots of land.
You're evolving into Greg Norman. You can have sod farms and a vineyard. You can have it all.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for coming on. I appreciate that you guys' time. Sorry it was a little truncated, but it was hopefully people enjoy the discussion.
Appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, glad to be here.
All right.